This hour's top stories: Palestinians say a U.S. brokered normalization deal between Israel and Morocco will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Russia denounces new U.S. sanctions against a number of Russian entities, saying they will deepen a crisis in bilateral ties. And Germany reports a record number of nearly 30,000 new coronavirus cases and almost 600 new deaths in 24 hours. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Palestinians have condemned a U.S.-brokered normalization agreement between Morocco and Israel. The Palestine Liberation Organization called Morocco's decision unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter Thursday. Morocco is the fourth Arab state to normalize ties with Israel since August. Three others to do so were Bahrain, I should say, the United Arab Emirates and Sudan. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner has said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has criticized Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for reciting a controversial poem on Iran's territorial integrity. Zarif said Erdogan was uninformed that what he ill-recited refers to the forcible separation of areas north of Aras River from the Iranian motherland. The top Iranian diplomat said no one can speak ill of Iran's northwestern region of Azerbaijan. He also accused the Turkish leader of undermining the sovereignty of the Republic of Azerbaijan. On Thursday, Erdogan started his speech at a military parade in Baku with an old poem. The poet had lamented what he called the forcible separation of Azerbaijan from Iran based on Golestan and Turkmenchai treaties. They were concluded between the Russian Empire and Iran's Qajar dynasty more than two centuries ago. The treaties saw areas north of the Aras River separate from Iran. Political commentator Dr. Mohammad Marandi says Turkish President Erdogan has never shown friendship or true friendship towards the Iranian people.
Well, I think what Dr. Zarif said was quite generous, and that the intentions of President Erdogan unfortunately were not benign. And the problem with President Erdogan is that despite the fact that Iran helped him from the very beginning to come to power in Turkey and helped him when the coup was about to overthrow his government, despite that, President Erdogan has never really showed true friendship towards the Iranian people, let alone the people across the region. Unfortunately, when he came to power, he kept his strong relations with Israel. The Israeli regime has an embassy in Turkey. They have direct flights, they do business together. Despite the rhetoric and despite some Turks being killed in the flotilla by the Israeli regime, I think 10 Turks were killed, he maintained those relations. So the hypocrisy that he's shown over the years, whether it's in supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda and working with NATO in Syria, whether it was supporting Saudi Arabia during the initial years in the genocide in Yemen, and the subjugation of the people of Bahrain, he supported that as well, the crushing of their dissent. Across the board, his policies have been horrible.
Iranian-based Al-Mustafa International University released a statement condemning the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the institution. The university said that blacklisting a university is a sign of obscurantism by the U.S. Earlier, we discussed that matter in detail with our guests in our news review program.
Welcome to the news review. Iran-based Al-Mustafa International University has condemned the United States for imposing sanctions against it. In a statement, the university said the move reveals Washington's hegemonic and arrogant nature. It stresses that blacklisting a university is a sign of obscurantism. The statement also accuses Washington of promoting terrorism and extremism in the world, noting that the U.S. is in no position to carry out such moves against other nations. Recently, the U.S. Treasury Department imposed sanctions on Al-Mustafa International University over alleged ties with the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Now, let's get some insight on this. Joining me will be Sabah Zuhalar Rezvi, peace and justice activist and analyst out of the city of Qom. Good to have you with us. What's your assessment of Washington's sanctions on a university?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Actually, United States of America is, you know, amid the cascade of the insane activities, insane decisions taken against Iran. So, initially speaking, let's have a look to what they have mentioned in the official statement released by the Treasury Department of the United States of America, specifically the Office for, controlling the foreign assets. They have mentioned that Al-Mustafa International University of Iran is facilitating the recruitment activities of IRGC Quds Force. This is what they have claimed. And then later on, they have also mentioned that the students of this particular university are, according to the claim, involved in the, intelligence processes as well. Without, of course, mentioning or presenting any document, they have just, claimed like this. And based on that, they have put this university in the blacklist, sanctioning it. One important point, let's not forget. First of all, what they have claimed, they have said that this is because some of the students of this university, based on their claim, recruited to go to Syria and fight inside Syria. Let's not forget the context of the Syrian crisis. And let's not forget that if Iran and Iranians were not there in Syria, the geopolitics of the region was going to be totally different. But all this has nothing to do with Al-Mustafa International University. Al-Mustafa University is actually a university with tens of thousands of graduate students and also maybe more than 10,000 students currently studying in different branches of it across the globe and also inside Iran. It's an official university under the Iranian higher education, so everything is clear about this university. And I believe what United States of America has said against the allegations of Americans against this university has no basis, but there is something really important behind this. Just as a proof, as a clue, if I want to present why all these allegations are false, you should know that currently in the city of Qom, more than 10,000 students from across the globe are studying. If as per their claim, this university was going to recruit its students to go for fight inside Syria, the numbers of those who were there from this university were too much.
Mr. Rezvi, thank you for that. But if that's the case, that's your justification, the whole universities in Iran should be facing that sanction because there were volunteers from almost all the universities.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you for that. Let me go to Madison and ask also Kevin Barrett's opinion on this. Kevin, over to you. How do you look at this sanction on Al-Mustafa University?
Well, this is another example of the way that academic freedom is now a dead letter here in the West. As little as 20 to 30 years ago, people in American universities took the principle of academic freedom very seriously. And they believed that as those of us who've jumped through the hoops and reached positions in the academy have used our critical thinking skills to analyze different questions, we've arrived at very different positions on all sorts of very important issues. And it was critically important to try to preserve the right of people in universities to take positions and to debate and even to support things that were almost borderline illegal. That I remember some cases of that from my days in the universities in the 1980s and 1990s, people supporting the Unabomber and things like that. And there's still some of that, although David Skrbina, who edits the Unabomber, has essentially had to leave the University of Michigan recently. But in all sorts of areas, we've seen the erosion of this idea of academic freedom in the West No longer can pro-Palestinians have even Zoom events at American universities. A dozen plus professors have been harassed or forced out. And now they're reaching around the world to try to shut down freedom of inquiry, free debate, freedom to hold and to put into practice widely different beliefs in universities by sanctioning this university simply because some students went and fought against Daesh. That's bizarre. I mean, I can see why they would have a problem with the university, say, in Saudi Arabia that has sent people to help Daesh. But in this case, obviously what's going on is that the U.S. government is completely under the thumb of the government of Israel, which likes Daesh, but finds Iran and the opponents of Daesh to be a threat to its continued genocide of Palestine. Mm-hmm. So they told the Americans to just go after Iran in every possible way, and there have been so many cases of this kind of ridiculous overreach.
Okay, thank you very much for your insight and contribution. We had Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert out of medicine, and Sabah Zuhal Rezvi, peace and justice activist and analyst from the Iranian City of Qom.
Welcome back. Russia has denounced new U.S. sanctions against a number of Russian entities, saying they will deepen a crisis in bilateral ties.
The actions of the U.S. administration are just another unfriendly and detrimental move against Russia, which will deepen the crisis in bilateral relations. The allegations that Russian officials are responsible for human rights violations are groundless and beneath criticism.
Russian ambassador called the sanctions an attempt by the U.S. to distract public attention from its own problems. The new measures target a number of Russian officials and firms over what the U.S. calls links to the Chechen leader. The measures were announced by the U.S. Treasury Department on Thursday. It has accused the targeted entities of human rights violations, including torture. The U.S. had previously blacklisted Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov on similar accusations. Now, the United States reportedly plans to impose sanctions on Turkey over Russian S-400 air defense systems Ankara received last year. Reuters says the sanctions would target Turkey's presidency of defense industry and its head. The news agency has cited several U.S. sources, including three officials, for its report. They have said the measures would be announced as early as Friday. The Turkish lira weakened as much as 1.4% following the news. A senior Turkish official said the sanctions would backfire and hurt ties with the U.S. Ankara started receiving the Russian S-400s in July of last year and tested them as recently as October. In response, the U.S. said it was removing Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program. While the European Union plans more sanctions against Turkey over its gas exploration activities in disputed Mediterranean waters, EU leaders decided at a Thursday summit to prepare a list of Turkish targets for the sanctions. A diplomat said individuals responsible for drilling in the contested waters are among those to be targeted. The diplomat said Turkey could even face more sanctions if it pursues actions considered provocative by the EU. The bloc's member state, Greece, has been at odds with Turkey since August. That is when Turkey sent an exploration ship to Mediterranean waters claimed by Greece. Athens says the Turkish activities violate its territory. Turkey rejects this and says it's not concerned about EU sanctions.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed. The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Now, COVID-19 hospitalizations keep soaring in the U.S., even affecting patients who do not have the disease. Official figures show COVID hospitalizations reached a record high of over 107,200 on Thursday. The figures also show corona patients occupied nearly half of all staffed ICU beds last week. That was up from 37% in the first week of November. Government data show one-third of all U.S. hospitals are almost out of ICU space. Doctors say the impact is not just on people with COVID, it's on anyone who needs hospital care. The U.S. has the largest coronavirus case tally in the world with nearly 15.6 million cases. Its total deaths are above 292,000. Well, COVID-19 is surging across Europe as well, with several countries reporting a record increase in their daily cases or fatalities. Germany on Friday reported nearly 30,000 new cases in 24 hours. That was a record daily number for a second day in a row. New deaths were almost 600. Germany's total virus deaths are nearly 21,000 out of over 1.2 million cases. Russia, the same day, posted a record 613 deaths in 24 hours. That takes total fatalities there to nearly 45,900. Russia's overall COVID cases are almost 2.6 million. In Ukraine, infections have increased by 13,500 in the past 24 hours. The total is now over 872,000. And that's it with international news.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country. to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
You should not underestimate the coronavirus. Well, as you see, the officials in charge are really sacrificing themselves. Physicians, nurses, managers, and others are all working hard. Therefore, we should carry out our duties. Keeping social distance, wearing a mask, and observing the instructions given, such as washing hands, are necessary tasks that should be carried out. There is a debate about Arbaeen. Well, some people love Imam Hussein and Arbaeen. It is clear. All of us do. Well, many of you have gone on an Arbaeen pilgrimage, but I have been deprived of it, although I have been willing to go. Although we are away from you, we speak in your memory, from a poem by Hafiz. However, participating in the Arbaeen rally depends on the opinion of the officials in the National Anti-Corona Headquarters. If they say no, and so far they have said no, everyone should follow and obey. If we go to the border to express our love, this is not a good course of action. We can do so at home. There are 2-3 ziyaras for Arbaeen. On Arbaeen Day, all the people can read the Arbaeen ziyara in an attentive manner and complain to Imam Hussein, greetings be upon him, saying, O Master of Martyrs, we wish to come, but it was not possible as things are like this. The Imam will pay attention to us and help us remove this obstacle.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
That Allah the Exalted will ordain good for the Iranian nation in all areas, that He will reward our dear soldiers who made great endeavors, and that He will raise the position of our dear martyrs. I hope that God will associate our magnanimous Imam, who was and still is the first link in the chain of the great movement of the Iranian nation. Our dear Imam Khomeini continues to guide us with his saints, and that He will reward him. I hope that He will reward him for the valuable things that he did in his lifetime. I hope that God will help all you dear brothers and the officials in the armed forces, government officials, and officials in various other divisions to carry out your duties. May He guide all of us, God willing. Greetings be upon you, and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Face to Face. Dear listeners, what you hear now is an interview with Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh about ongoing developments in that country.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me. It's been 2 years since the Sudanese revolution, since the protests began. What do you think has been the main challenges, and have people's lives significantly changed since the revolution?
I think that the transition itself, it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge for the government, for the Sovereign Council, and for the political parties. And if we study the experience of transitional period in many countries, it's always been very difficult time with a lot of challenges and obstacles. And we face the same challenges and obstacles here in Sudan. It was difficult even to change the mentality of the people, the ordinary people, the people in the civil service, in the governments, who used to be under dictatorship for military and dictatorship for 30 years. And at the same time, we have the problems of also changes in the military side, in the security, in the police department, in the army, which they are now partners. So all these were the difficulties we are facing. Some of them are expected already. We expect to have such problems. Some of them are new ones. At the beginning of the revolution and before that, people were hoping that we are going to have a full civilian transitional government and transitional organs. No one expected such situation of multiple military and civilian. So this is a new challenge. We found ourselves in a position where the civilian are negotiating with the army and they should be both on board. We were not prepared for that. The political parties were not prepared for that. The FFC, which she led the revolution, were not prepared for that. So this was a de facto situation that you have to deal with it. So this has also created new problems. Since this government came, we are trying to deal with these difficulties and challenges. I think we have been successful in some of them, especially, for example, in the side of peace agreement. It was a success, although, of course, some of the armed movement are still out of this peace negotiation. We hope that they are going to join. And the main challenges, I think, was economic one. And I will say, frankly, we were not successful in that. We still have a lot of problems. We knew from the beginning that we are going to have a very difficult economy, the old regime. And we had some ideas that we are going to overcome this problem. Unfortunately, and again, frankly, I will say that we were not successful in overcoming this problem. We're still suffering. Part of it, I think, will be solved because of the lifting of the American sanctions. Part of it, not all of it. But at least it will open doors for investment. It will open door for Sudan to rejoin the international banking system, which is one of the problems we are facing. But this is now is the main challenge, that the economic one.
And something you mentioned was you did not anticipate joining the military. You was expecting a full civilian government.
Yes.
What happened? How have we got to this situation where we have this kind of partnership between the military and the civilian government?
What happened is that simply, that the army intervened when they knew that the revolution will continue. And I think they have reached to the point where they think that the old regime cannot continue. And maybe they were thinking of if a new regime came, then there will be some negative aspects, negative result on the army, so they decided to intervene. So it appeared at the beginning that they are intervening in favor of the civilians, the protesters. But of course, when they did that, they asked for a share of power. And I think this is expected and natural in such situations. We have the same experience in 1985, where also the army intervened in the last moment, and so they were part of the transitional government. It lasted only for 1 year, but this time here is 4 years. So I think when they intervened, when they took the power and they ousted the old regime, then the civilian FFC found themselves in a situation where they have to negotiate. And they came there, the African Union intervened, Ethiopia intervened, the mediators came in, and it was a situation, as I said, it's a de facto situation where you have to negotiate with the army. And it was from that day, 11th of April 2019, people expected that the army will be on board with the civilian. The negotiation was what's the share of the army will be and what's the share of the civilians. And I think because of the balance of power, by that time we reached to this result. Again, maybe it was not anticipated, it was not the same, the type of civilian transition government that people were expected, but this is how things went. And so it started from August 2019, this civilian and military partnership.
And it's a process, the transitional period is a process, and at the end of the process, the hope and the aim is for a democratically elected government.
Yes.
But what's to say the army doesn't do the same thing again, and they once again try to share power with a democratically elected government?
I think that will depend on the balance of power. Because we have this, what we call a constitutional declaration, and the constitutional declarations put an end to the military participation by the end of the transitional period, where we should finish the constitution, the new constitution, and we are going to have an election, and of course a new democratic government will take control. And the army will go back to the barracks, will be just doing what the army in the other countries do. This is what the constitutional declaration and the political agreement agreed upon. And I think everything depends on this balance of power, because if the civilian are weak, then maybe the army will have a new ideas. But day after day, there is a progress on that.
And we've traveled to many places on our trips, and one of the places we went to is Mayo, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Khartoum. It seems like the economically disenfranchised, which seems to be getting larger, it seems to be growing. What message can the Transitional Council give to them about economic prosperity in the future, or at least uplifting them from the economic situation that they're in?
That is linked to two issues. One of them is political, and the other one is economic. Political one is peace. Most of the people who are living in these areas came from the war-affected areas, and they are live in the margins of the big cities. And also, they don't have, some of them, most of them don't have a skill, they were not educated, so they are doing marginal jobs. And I think if we successful enough in implementing the peace agreement, most of these people will go back to their areas, where they are farmers or whatever the profession they have, and they resettle in their own areas where they have at least some peace and stability. That I think will improve the economic situation of them, because as I said, they will not be in the margin of their own life. They will be in the center of the life they are used to do, to live in the past. So this is the political side, that if we have enough peace and stability and security in the war-affected area, people will go back to these areas and live ordinary life. The other side is the economic one. As I said, we were not successful in that till now, because we promised people of working on sustainable development, and that we are trying to find way where the people will at least find education, health care, without spending a lot of money on that. That would be the government responsibility. And we still, although we promised to start from day one to do that, we didn't fulfill this for them. Because I think most of the problems they have is with education and health care. They are spending a lot of money on that, although they don't have enough money to do that. So this is part of the program the government promised to do, to work on it, free education for all people of Sudan, and free basic health care. And that, as I said, because we were not successful in pulling the country from this economic crisis, we still couldn't do that. I think, as I said again, when with this lifting sanctions, the American sanction on Sudan, now we will be open for receiving help and fund from international finance institution that will help improving the country. Also, I think we are going to receive a lot of investment. Sudan is rich with its resources, natural resources, that will open door for investors. And rejoining the international banking system will also attract investors. I think with new investments, that will help improving the situation in the country and will improve the situation in these war-affected areas and the marginal areas.
So you mentioned the delisting of Sudan from the state sponsor of terror. Many international observers say that had less to do with the compensation offered to American victims of terror and more to do with Sudan agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. What was your response?
At the beginning, that was not the case. We have started from day one. In September 2019, the negotiation with the Americans on the political and legal side of this case of delisting Sudan from state sponsoring terrorism, and the compensation for the families of the victims of terrorist act that Sudan, the old Sudan government, was linked to. And the issue of normalizing relationship with Israel was never, by that time, was never mentioned. We started, as I said, in September 2019. So the negotiation went on the political side with the American administration and with the victims' families, the legal side. And that went on for maybe 7 or 8 months. And it went on successfully until we reached the point where we reduce the amount of money that the Sudan government will pay for as a compensation for the victims' families. In the last few months, then, the question of normalization with Israel was raised. And what was not raised only with Sudan, as you may see, with Emirates, with Bahrain, with other countries. And we insisted on two things, that separation of the two issues. We used to say to them, and that was said to Secretary of State Bami when he came to Sudan, that these are two separate issues. Delisting Sudan from SST, we are negotiating on that in 7 or 8 months. Normalization with Israel is a very controversial issue. It could be discussed, of course. There's no problem in discussing it in Sudanese media or discussion with the public, whatever it is. It could be discussed, but separated from the delisting of Sudan from SST. This is number one. Number two, our response to him was that we are a transitional government. This issue is not one of our mandate. And that is what we agreed upon in the civilian government with the FFC. We had a joint meeting a day before he came, and we agreed that this is not a part of our mandate as a transitional government. This should be left to an elected government to discuss it. Then the American pressure on Sudan started. Until that time, he didn't say that it was linked, the delisting with the normalization, but he used to raise the issues until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election. And I think it was Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump want to have some cards in his favor. Part of it is convincing some Arab countries to normalizing relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week, it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize the relationship with Israel. It was a very difficult situation. And the economic expert, our economics expert, our economic minister said that Sudan cannot tolerate the sanction for 7 or 2 months after election. If we said no, then we will wait for the election, then the new administration will have 6, 7, 8 months until they have done all the heavy duty that they are supposed to do, the homework, until they can discuss things with Sudan. This is a very long time Sudan cannot tolerate. So the government had to do that, had to promise that they are going to normalize relationship with Israel, but there was one condition. The whole issue will go to the Legislative Council. The Legislative Council is supposed to be established in a few weeks, that the whole issue of normalizing relationship with Israel will go to the Legislative Council. If it is approved by the Legislative Council, then the formal step will start. So that was the agreement. Until the election, we all watched what happened in the American election. And now I think that the issue of delisting will go on, because the Democrats in the Congress approved it before even the election. So there was no problem in delisting Sudan from that. We are confident that this issue will go on successfully. The only issue still left is Sudan should be given some type of immunity from future cases, because paying compensation to these families, maybe that it will open door for some other families. And some of the senators have raised the issue of September 11 victims. They said that some of the families want also to sue Sudan. So this will be something that endless process. And we have said many times, even in the agreement, when we signed the agreement to pay the compensation for the families in Sudan, actually Sudanese people have nothing to do with terrorism. And that was an act of an ousted government. And it is not fair that Sudanese people should continue paying the price of that, for that, because the old regime hurt Sudanese people more than they hurt the American or the people of other countries. So we shouldn't pay the price twice. We have paid the price for 30 years, and now there is a new democratic government. It is suffering to try to take the country in the transitional process. It should be helped by the whole world and by the American administration, not to be punished for crime committed by the old regime. We hope that the new administration will be open. We are also optimistic that the new administration will consider that. At least the Democrats say that they are more concerned with the democracy and human rights in the world. And I think if they want to present Sudan as a model for the region, they should help Sudan improving the situation of human rights and democracy. And that, of course, will be one of the conditions if you want to promote democracy in the region, to help the new democratic regime like Sudan.
And do you think the economic situation, the long queues for bread, for fuel, do you think that was used by the Americans as a negotiation tactic to force Sudan to normalize relations?
I cannot say that directly, but at least they didn't help Sudan to overcome such problems. It was not created by the Americans. Maybe they are not used directly, but at least the Sudan was not helped in trying to overcome these economic problems.
And one of the issues that has come up is accountability. One of the most infamous parts of the revolution was the June the 3rd massacre. Yet when I've spoken to different people, they have very little hope that there'll ever be accountability for those that ordered the killings. What would you say to those people?
We are working hard on that. It's a very difficult task. Very, very difficult task. We have formed an independent committee to investigate what happened on the 3rd of June, and it's working with difficulties. and they have asked for extension for their, they were given 3 months, and then they asked for extension for 3 months, and now we are in the third extension of the 3 months. They are complaining they have almost about 3,000 witnesses. They have listened to 3,000 witnesses. They have hundreds of videotapes that they are looking and try to verify. And the task is very difficult. They are facing a very difficult time. They are working in a very difficult situation, and we understand that. And we try to explain that to the people. It is not an easy task. It needs some time. We should give them the time they ask for, so that when they finish their reports, the reports will be a very convincing report. So they have to spend the time they ask for. This is one thing. But in other cases, there is now ongoing trials on some of the martyrs of the revolution. Said there is now about 5 trials going on in Al-Ubayyid, and here in Khartoum, in Al-Hasahisa. Those are people killed during the revolution. And fortunately, at least the people who did committed the crime were identified. And this is one of the problems. Many people killed, and you cannot identify who did that. But on those cases where the people are identified, they are now on trials. It is maybe a slow process. But I think this is the type of justice we want to do. We want a full trial. We want the ordinary judicial system to do that. We didn't have a special court for such things as the old regime used to do. And we give full right to those accused to have lawyers, to have time for their lawyers to examine the case. So this is how justice is done. I know it is sometimes slow, and maybe the people don't like that. They want to find a very fast trial, but I think fast trial will not be a just trial. A bit patient for justice to be done. At the same time, people want to cooperate, because you know, in many cases that is on trial, the court sometimes they don't have enough evidence. So we call on people who have some information to come and appear on this course and to give their information that they have. Maybe it is slow, we know that. Also, one of the problems we have problems with the Attorney General office is always complaining of not having enough people to work with them. We have people with the judicial, we have problems with the judicial system, which also inherited from the old regime, but we are working hard to deal with these problems.
And my final question, those that look at what's going on in Sudan argue that Sudan is being influenced by regional actors. Sudan plays a pivotal role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and there's clearly Saudi and Emirati influence within the military council. How does Sudan chart an independent foreign policy while these regional actors have such vested interest in the Republic of Sudan?
That's true. I mean, part of this situation was inherited. For example, the involvement of Sudanese army in Yemen was inherited from the old regime, and we are trying to find way to finish that. We are concerned with what happened in Yemen. We are also concerned with what's happening in Saudi Arabia. But involving directly in a war is not the right thing to do, and to help the situation to be solved, the crisis in Yemen. We have a very long relationship with Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, we don't think sending army is the right way to help Saudi Arabia or to help Yemen. So we are trying to deal with such situation, at least to reach a point where we can pull the Sudanese army from Yemen and try to play a positive role in solving the crisis in Yemen. And you know what's happening in Libya, what's happening in South Sudan, what is happening now in Ethiopia. We are living in a very difficult areas in the world, very difficult situation where the countries around Sudan have a lot of problems. And that puts Sudan within different axes. From day one, we say that we want Sudan to be independent, and we to have independent foreign policies. But also that cannot happen in a moment. We are aware of that. We are aware that Sudan is considered part of the Saudi Emirates acts. We want Sudan to be very independent in its foreign policy and having a normal relationship with all countries. And now I think the relationship with Qatar has improved a bit, and we hope that we are going to improve it more so we can have the normal relationship with all countries. But one of the main thing people of Sudan ask for is this foreign independent foreign policy. And I think during the transition, we are moving, maybe slowly, but we are moving towards that.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on yet another episode of Back to Reality. Only on IRIB English Radio, I am your humble host, Zainab. In the studio with me, I've got two special guests that I'm totally excited to talk to about today's topic. Brother Muzaffar, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, sister. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And Brother Wahid.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Some teachers used to see my name on the list and just be like, Mustafa? And I'd be like, well, so you see a brown kid and you see a long name beginning with M and you just assume it's Mustafa. Like, can you try and read it? At least, you know what I mean?
Where is that, in England?
Yeah. Oh.
Speaking of that, it's such a good thing that you brought up the brown kid and the name and the list and the read and the try and the ing and the len. Because I wanna talk about a world, if we can even imagine such a thing, because it's such an integral, innate part of our existence. Uh-huh. A world without distinctions, a world without discrimination, a world without, you know, certain standards that set people apart from each other,
mm-hmm.
certain standards that we base our treatment toward other people on. Can you even imagine a world like that? Because I can't, to be honest.
Would you want to live in a world like that?
I'm at conflict with this whole concept, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself in the Quran says that I created you as qaba'il lita'arafu.
Lita'arafu.
Right? I created you as different tribes and colors, and so that you might distinct each other from
yeah,
one another.
Yeah, I think that that's part of the
distinction.
But that has nothing to do with discrimination and inequality.
Yes.
Hold on. Can I just point this out? That is a beautiful part of our existence, that everybody is different. I love that.
Like the three of us sitting in the studio right now, we are so
that is beautiful.
Different.
That we're different.
Yeah.
The beauty is in the difference. But we're talking about inequality and discrimination.
Okay, can we define these terms? Because nowadays it's kind of, you know, really crazy. You know, people in the West, for example, some white people, they come
unjustice.
And say that. They come and say that they're colorblind, and then, you know, they're just ignoring the fact that this is black or this is brown. And
not only in the West, but in the East, too. We have that in the
East. Yeah, the colorblind idea? Yeah.
No. Racism in the East.
We're talking about racism. We're talking about negativity. We're talking about you being discriminated in the line, in the queue.
Because of
whatever, your job application, you want to be employed somewhere, you're getting discriminated. There's some injustice with that word,
it's
discrimination.
Horrible, yeah. May Allah destroy it.
Yeah. Yara, but where
do you
guys
we should be a little bit more
from?
Careful when we say may Allah destroy it, because we should first of all point fingers to ourselves. What does our jurisprudence say when it comes to, in regards to discrimination?
We need to discriminate between Muslim and non-Muslim, because they are different.
Yeah, but the definition of discrimination that I said comes with injustice. It comes with
negativity.
Okay,
well, you've got to say injustice towards non-Muslims then. because discrimination is naturally there. Some people are Muslim. They've accepted that.
Of course,
right.
But like when you want to get married. Then.
Injustice.
Yeah, injustice.
Injustice.
Right, okay, injustice, yeah.
Because
okay,
injustice so is not allowed in Islam, whether no matter who it's toward. Even if it's your enemy, you have to treat even your enemies.
But that is, again, a definition. That is, again, in an interpretation. What is injustice?
Okay, if we're going to get all fiqhi on that, we are going to have to save it for some other show, like Jurisprudence with Sayyid Wahid Alawi. And it's not this show. This is Back to Reality.
Yeah,
so
just before we move on, sister, I have to say, in the defense of fiqh, unless you give some examples, I've never seen something like that.
Brother Mulafan, I'm asking you this because you are the more complexion one among the three of us. Subhanallah, al-Ali al-Azim. But I'm sure that because of your complexion, you've faced a lot of discrimination in your days.
Oh, yeah. I still face it. But it's interesting. It's okay, so if you go to a place like England, they can't tell the difference between a black person and a brown person. And some black people are fairer than I am,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So for them, it's all the same. It's like, you know, I had
like
a black friend.
It's like for the Eastern people who feel all white people are the same.
Right, exactly. So there, it's always going to be a problem. I don't know what it is. It's the darker skin tones. And it doesn't matter where you go in the world. The darker the skin, the more you will be prejudiced against. In this current time, I can't really see any place in the world where it's the reverse.
Mm-hmm. No, when you go to Africa, it's the complete reverse. I actually had an African friend. She was from a wealthy African country. Wealthy not necessarily in terms of money, but they had wealthy soil. And she lived in the tribal system and this and that. And she said their servants were white.
Uh-huh. Right. So there are places.
Something.
There must be places, right?
Yeah, there must be some places among some African tribes, may God bless them, the albino is always the outcast because they look so gosh darn different.
Right.
Everyone
is
so beautifully black, and this person is so beautifully white, and they can't grasp it. And they're right? Okay. Brother Wahid, have you ever found yourself discriminating someone?
Oh, yeah.
Do tell.
The thing is that we have some hidden racism.
We do.
And hidden racism.
We definitely need to talk about where it stems
hidden
from.
Hidden racism is something that we have in some countries and country
are
I come from.
Racist?
In Sweden, we have racism, but it's more hidden because it's not something nice. It's not nice to be racist or called racist. So basically, you discriminate when you want to have a job. You want to employ someone, you choose the one who is white, blonde, and blue eye. All right? So you don't choose the one with the hijab. You don't choose the one with the name of Mustafa or Muzaffar, right? So you choose someone else who is more
normal,
looking like.
More normal, yeah.
Normal, right? And then you have something called positive racism.
Is there even such a thing?
Or reversed racism.
Yeah,
no,
that.
Positive racism.
What's
I think
that?
They call that, the term is positive racism. For example, if a person who comes from Sri Lanka converts to Islam, we don't show that much joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. But imagine in some countries here in the East, but imagine that a white person coming from England converts to Islam. That is something else. Or the way we behave towards people in this region, in West Asia, against, for example, white Westerners, and how we treat, even if they might be non-Muslims, and how we treat our brothers and sisters.
Wait, why is that positive racism?
Our brothers and sisters.
No, it's reverse racism.
Yeah,
but
they give you extra points. They give you extra
privileges.
Advantages.
Privileges, right.
They give you extra privileges, and that is called positive racism.
Oh, no. By positive racism, he means they're not
right.
taken advantage of based due to their
you,
race.
They give you privileges.
They're given privileges
because
due to their
you're
race.
White and
so
I'm
no,
not.
Let's
they
call
give
it,
you
let's
privileges.
Let's call it white privilege. Let's call it what it is. It's white privilege because
well, racism,
there's no such thing
yeah.
as positive racism.
Yeah, exactly.
I embrace
racism.
You more than the other person.
Yeah, that,
and
that's just racism.
That person might be a non-Muslim, but I embrace you more.
Right.
Than my Muslim brother.
And it's especially not positive because it still leaves space for discrimination against some other race, right?
Right.
I personally, thank you so much for not asking, have never faced any sort of distinction
or
racism. I have seen people, unfortunately, in societies, and it makes my heart shatter into smithereens when I see racism and this sort of discrimination.